This is Purple Radio on demand.
Hi, I'm Sam.
And I'm Louis.
And we welcome you to the final episode of Chalkboard Ultra in this series. We're somehow still investigating the most interesting problems in all of mathematics.
So what are we discussing today, Sam?
In this week's episode, we're getting stuck into the glue that holds all of mathematics together.
Hold on. Glue on? I thought you said we haven't found it yet.
No. That's the what holds all of physics together. None of this uncertainty business. No. We're here to talk about true constants.
Constant what?
Well, just constants, you know, like pi, e, phi. Those are the more famous ones.
I assume you want to discuss some more of the hidden constants.
I wouldn't say any of them are hidden, just less used. There's actually lots to say about the ones I mentioned, how pi isn't always about circles, and how e has some lovely applications in finance. Although today I do just want to talk about pi, because with any luck, this episode will be released on the 14th of March, known to us mathematicians as Pi Day.
Hold on, Sam. Didn't we already do an episode on dates and calendars?
True, we did. But this time, instead of discussing the mathematics of dates, we shall just be celebrating a very special date in mathematics.
You make it sound like a leap day isn't worth celebrating.
Hey, I never said that. All I'm saying is it's a wonderful day for pi. Ah, yes, pi. The most famous mathematical constant. Who knew the ratio of a circle's circumference to its diameter would cause so much bother?
Well, I think you've hit on something there, Sam. Why pi?
Why pi?
Why such fascination around it? As you said, it's only the circumference to the diameter.
Pi does appear in other places. Remember our Sum of Surprises episode?
How could I not? It came up a few times, if I recall.
Yes. Lots of nice geometrical reasonings for where pi originates from, but there's so much more to say. The origins are rather mystic. From the dawn of time, mathematics has been there in the form of constants that ubiquitously appear in the description of natural laws, providing mankind with the handy tools to get closer to the truth and tear the mask of nature to stare at the raw face of the universe.
Now, the last time someone read something like that on Chalkboard Ultra, one of the co-hosts disappeared. Don't worry, listener, I am still here.
Thank goodness for that.
What I find interesting, though, if we're going to go back to pi and not this strange rambling you started, Sam, is that various civilizations across the world all knew what pi was, but because of its irrational nature, could never put their finger on it precisely. The Babylonians suggested it was 3.125. The Egyptians said it was 4 times 8 over 9 all squared, which is about 3.1605. And in the Bible, it's inferred to be 3.
Yeah, in the Bible, I know this, it's related to ratios. I think the Old Testament gives a first ratio of 3 to 1, which would just be 3. The next ratio is 22 to 7, which is what gives us 22 on 7 as a bit of an approximation to pi. They give a few more. The most accurate one, I think, is 355 to 113, that should get you about 6 decimal places for pi.
Pretty good.
It is, actually. And after this, though, the fascination was taken by the Greeks, and they developed a new way to find pi, to draw shapes of many sides inside of a circle and calculate its area as a bit of an approximation.
I remember you saying this in the chance episode. Wasn't it Archimedes who started this?
Yes, it was. The Greek philosopher Archimedes used, for example, a polygon shape that has 96 sides to find the value of pi. An eneaconta hexagon, if you will.
I will not.
Using these ideas, later down the line, Chinese mathematicians Liu Hui and Zhu Chongzi used counting rods to create polygons with thousands of sides. I think 16,000 sides is one they used, which got the approximations of pi scarily close.
Let's move on from one constant to another. Wasn't pi almost tau?
Yeah, you're right. Tau is another Greek letter, but it is a constant used in physics mainly as 2 times pi. In most areas of maths, it's very nice and pleasing to work with unit shapes, and in particular unit circles. These are circles that have a radius of 1. Now, if we were to talk about the circumference of the unit circle, then the ratio between the circle circumference and its radius is roughly 6.28, which is 2 pi or tau.
Okay, that makes a bit of sense. If you want to talk about a fraction of a circle, then its angle is simply tau multiplied by that fraction. The use of tau equals 2 pi makes a lot of formulae quite nice to use. Trig identities, if you met them at A level. Fourier series, if you might see them further on in uni. They're also very clean, I'd imagine, on the paper.
Yeah, quite. And even Euler noticed this, actually. Euler is very famously tied in with pi because he was the first one to use the Greek letter as circle notation. But in one of his very first texts, he labels pi equals 6.28. So pi was almost tau.
That's a bit absurd. How did this change come about then?
Well, a very brilliant mathematician a few years later published another text that had labelled pi equals 3.14. Do you know who that was?
Not particularly, no.
That was also Euler. So Euler contradicted himself, and or so people thought when he labelled pi equals 3.14 because he was studying semicircles at the time. And one of his other texts labels pi as 1.57, which a keen mathematician might know that that is pi over 2. And so how come he kept on changing the definition of pi? Was because he used it as a circle parameter rather than a circle constant. You know, like how when we measure angles, we usually use theta as our angle of parameterization. Well, he did the same, but just for pi. But a lot of his texts were focused on semicircles, and so he then made it kind of a convention that pi was the semi-circumference constant, if you like, because that's the ratio of the semi-circumference to the unit radius.
Well, if we're talking about pi being changed to other things, have you ever heard the idea that pi could have been 3.2?
3.2? What? No.
It's a true story. We've got to look back to the 1890s. There was a guy called Edwin Goodwin, some mathematician who thought he had solved one of the most famous unsolved problems in mathematics. It goes all the way back to ancient Greece. It's called squaring the circle. Can you find a square that has the same area as a circle? Now, interestingly, the problem was a subject of a famous 17th century feud between Thomas Hobbes and John Wallace. In short, Hobbes said you could, Wallace said you couldn't, and this led to a lot of disagreement. But, Sam, you're looking a bit confused.
Well, yeah, it's because I know the problem squaring the circle quite well. Well, yeah, go through this. We'll talk about it after.
So anyway, just like Hobbes, and maybe Sam if he admits it soon, Edwin Goodwin thought that he'd solve the problem. But in this proof, he implied that pi was 3.2. So convinced was he that this was a perfect proof, he wanted to make it copyright. Why? Because anyone in the future using the proof would have to pay in royalties, even after death. Well, everyone except those who worked in the education sector in Indiana, which is where he was from.
Oh, well, how nice of him.
Indeed. So he made up a bill and tried to pass it into state law. The bill went through the Education Committee in the Indiana House of Representatives, and then the House as a whole passed it unanimously, 67 votes to none.
67 to none. So no one in that room was... Well, you don't even have to be a mathematician to know that pi isn't 3.2.
Supposedly there was more of a debate over which committee should actually handle it. Should it be finance? Should it be swamplands? Because it's related to some geometry stuff. But no, education.
Well, fair enough. And okay, so it went past the House of Representatives.
Thankfully, before the Indiana Senate could do the same, a mathematician called Professor Clarence Waldo heard the news and decided to coach these senators on some basic math before the bill reached them.
And did that work?
Yes. Thankfully, the Senate received the bill and threw it out, or rather, postponed it indefinitely.
Oh, well, thank goodness for that. Who actually knows where we could be now if we, you know, used pi as 3.2?
Well, it could be argued that this pi crisis would have been limited to Indiana and reversed in good time.
Okay, that's fine. But here's the problem I was thinking about. So you said this was going on in the 1890s?
1897.
1897, right. The problem he was trying to solve, squaring the circle, yeah, it is a famous problem. I know this. It was proved impossible in 1882. So what was Goodwin doing, what, 15 years later? Why was he working on an impossible problem?
Maybe no one told him. News travels slow. I know it's a very special day, but all I can hear is pi. No matter the area of maths you study, you'll always find yourself in circles around pi.
Okay, calm down slightly. it's because the universe quite literally revolves around pi, you know, whatever its true value may be. It was Kepler who was one of the first to research the motion of planets, and he found they move in circular patterns. We know, thanks to Einstein, that this is because we can imagine planets and stars as weights on a sheet of fabric, but no, that is a discussion for another time.
Quite.
But this immediately tells us that the things we know about the universe must involve pi. If we imagine ourselves at the center of the universe, which, as a physicist, we often do, then everything we observe outside of the Earth will point out radially. We actually need pi to calculate the size of the observable universe.
Well, surely that must take a lot of calculations.
What I love is that you really don't. Because it's just a huge circle with a straight line distance from us to the edge of the universe, as, you know, take that as the radius, multiply it by 2, then pi, you've got yourself the circumference.
Interesting, but still, as a lot of people know, pi is irrational, which means it goes on forever. Does this mean we can calculate the size of the unobservable universe?
I don't even know what you mean by that. Sounds like doom and gloom at the edge of the universe. There's many a Doctor Who story about that, I'm sure.
There is, but I don't think we should discuss that now. This arm is already too long. I mean, this podcast is already too long.
Anyhow, you only need surprisingly little pi to calculate this. If you want the circumference of our observable universe to the accuracy of the nearest proton, you only need the first 65 digits of pi.
Only the first 65?
Yeah.
So why are we bothering caring about the rest of the digits then? How many are there exactly?
As of 2023, we know 100 trillion decimal places.
But if we only need 65, then surely the rest of them are useless.
No, not quite useless. They spark a great deal of interest among mathematicians to find who can break the next record, most likely Emma Haruka, considering she has done the most recent 100 trillion digits. But it's because they're totally unpredictable. Actually, speaking of, here's a question you'll like, Louis. Are the digits of pi random?
Oh, that's a very good question. Well, yes and no. If you define random as without predictability and patterns, then yeah, sure, I'd say so. We don't really know what's going to come next. We've got a 1 in 10 chance of guessing, surely.
True.
However, there is an argument to be made that since we know with certainty the first 99 trillion digits, then surely it can't be random.
What about the digits we don't know? Would they be random? Would they kind of balance out the non-randomness of pi?
What do you mean, balance out? All right, could it be that the digits are random, but together they're not?
What? That's just pi without the pi.
All right. Here's a different question. Given the known digits of pi, can we infer what comes after?
That links back to when we talked about chance, I think. You know, you could spin a roulette wheel as many times as you like, and because of the law of large numbers, we know there's an overarching one-to-one ratio of red to black. Even if you spin 10 reds in a row, you know down the line that there must be a cluster of 10 blacks because, well, probability dictates it.
All right, so I think I get what you're trying to say. We expect the digit 4 to appear as often as the digit 7, and the digit string 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 to appear as often as 6 nines in a row, which, by the way, does exist. It's the Feynman point.
Oh, really? How far down the line is that?
I can't remember. I think it's like position 700 odd.
Oh, interesting.
The issue is, we don't even know if each decimal digit appears infinitely often in pi, let alone whether there's some more complex pattern waiting to be discovered. But remember, it's calculated, so can we say it is actually random? Someone is churning out these digits one by one.
They can't appear out of randomness. Sure.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Although, interestingly, it is conjectured that pi is a normal number, which means that all possible sequences of digits should appear equally as often. You might know Champernowne's constant, that's the most famous normal number, and that's created by quite literally taking every single number and putting them one after the other as a decimal. So it's 0.12345678910111212, as if it's, you know, 10, 11, 12, 13. And by construction, that will contain all possible sequences of numbers because it's just the numbers put together. So that by definition is normal.
Okay, so we talked about the endlessness of pi, but surely we can say that pi holds little meaning now. back in the day, the idea of computing digits of pi enthralled the greatest minds in the world. Archimedes, William Shanks, Ferguson, the one who corrected Shanks in his tinchy-winchy mistake. He computed 700 digits. But
yeah, so like Shanks computed...
500 was... Right.
Yeah, we'll talk about Shanks's mistakes a bit later on.
However, with the rise of computers and algorithms, the digits can be found with ease. So surely it's no longer special.
Well, we do have the development of huge supercomputers now with such high-precision algorithms. We need these to calculate pi, sure. But this optimization of computer software, it benefits the development of other software and hardware and allows us to do lots of other high-demand tasks really, really fast. You know, these take you from highly accurate weather forecasting, there's DNA sequencing, disease modeling even. You need computers to run these simulations, run these models to know how to treat things better or just understand the world a lot better. So perhaps it's not directly linked to pi, unfortunately.
There are many fun ways of calculating pi. For instance, you might remember in Chance we talked about the Monte Carlo method or the dartboard approach. There's actually another method similar to it. Have you heard of Buffon's needle?
Buffon's needle, no.
Well, this is the idea of, suppose you have a floor that's got parallel strips of wood, each with the same width between them, and you drop a needle onto this floor. Mm-hmm. What's the probability that the needle will lie across a line between the two strips? Now, geometrically, you can solve this. Similar with the Monte Carlo areas, you can find the probability and therefore rearrange for a value of pi. But of course, it is only approximation. And due to the way that you're flipping the needle, it might take you a while.
No, yes, very, very true. But I like these repeat methods of trying to get pi because they get you closer and closer to the true value. Like they use randomness for pi. There is a calculation you can do that has its origins in some elementary number theory. So we've talked about prime numbers before. There are numbers that are co-prime to each other if they don't share any factors. For example, 4 and 15 are co-prime because they don't share any factors, even though none of them are prime. Does that make sense? They don't share factors. Whereas like 2 and 10 are not co-prime because...
they share 2.
Exactly. Out of all the possible numbers, what is the probability that two numbers are co-prime?
6 over pi squared.
Right, yeah. It's a very famous result in number theory and a little bit of probability, that the probability that any two numbers do not share any factors is 6 divided by pi squared, which is an astounding result.
Again, isn't that the inverse of the Basel problem?
Yes, exactly. And it is where it comes from. You are a keen mathematician. I was just going to say the keen mathematician will know that's the inverse of pi squared over 6, the answer to the Basel problem. So go and do your homework. You know, you can go find some links to that. So I ran an Excel simulation because I wanted to actually test this myself. So I created 10 million random numbers and or at least it was 20 million, so I had 10 million pairs. And I did a function on each pair of numbers that asked if they shared a factor based on some fancy maths. And if they shared a factor, it was a 1. If they didn't, it was a 0. And I totaled it up and flipped it, multiplied by 6, took the square root, and I got a value of pi to 6 decimal places. So genuinely, it's the law of large numbers again. As you do it with more and more numbers, you will get to pi. And it's all well and good getting these approximations for pi, but how do we get the pi exactly? There are lots and lots of formulas that are nice. One of them in particular is called the Chudnovsky algorithm, developed by the Chudnovsky brothers in 1988. It's the one that is used for the calculations now, because with each iteration of this algorithm, you can get about 15 digits of pi. And so that does get it to you accurately. And it's, you know, I'm not going to bother with the formula. It's extremely, extremely complicated.
Well, I think because pi is irrational, this will never end, surely. We'll always be
looking for the
newest way of finding something. I mean, we mentioned quantum computing in the game theory episode. Something like that, I imagine, would definitely try to find a bit
it would
more.
Do it a lot faster. But I am now thinking of where should we go from here, because 100 trillion digits is an awful lot. You know, our most complex calculations are going to be involving only 65 digits of pi. It's the fact that we've been using the same algorithm over and over. It's just a bit of a thrill. It's like what Feynman said. There's lots of useful applications for math and physics, but it's not why we do them. We do it for fun.
It's nothing like a thrill clicking the button and seeing a new digit appear.
No, exactly. As well as computing pi with your randomness, it does appear in statistics in another way, doesn't it?
Yeah, the normal distribution, which is a famous, well, probably the most important distribution known to us, actually has a factor of pi in it.
And what, why is that?
Well, all probability distributions must integrate to one. That's what makes them valid. And the way that the normal distribution is that it's got a Gaussian integral inside it, which gives us a square root of pi. It's a famous result. And in order to make sure it integrates fully to one, we've got to divide by a square root of pi.
And so there is their factor of pi there, which I just find fascinating. Even in the depth of statistics, you cannot get yourself away from pi.
Well, I'd argue that for the most part, it doesn't really appear. It's just that gives us the many digits of numbers we get for probabilities. If you're using a probit function, you realize why do these numbers appear. It's probably because of pi.
I wonder, you know, if we link this to back to last week's episode, people do a lot of rounding. Because if you've got this infinitely long decimal that is a statistics, if you do rounding the wrong way, that could really shift your significance. Interesting. No, but outside of statistics, there are other experimental ways to get pi, one of them being in terms of pendulums. Because there is an equation for the time period of a pendulum. If you held a pendulum up and you let it swing, you could calculate the time it takes to return back to a certain spot, or you know, how long it would take to fully come to a stop. You rearrange that a little bit and you can get a value of pi that depends on the time it takes to revolve, I suppose, and the length of the pendulum itself.
But hang on, you're forgetting another constant, gravity. Isn't that another one that's never ending?
That is interesting. I'm interesting that you brought it up, because you're talking about the gravitational constant G. Misconception, it's the gravitational field strength. And what you might be referring to is the acceleration due to this gravitational field strength. It's different for every planet that you're on.
Oh, sorry. I didn't know that we were actually using this pendulum on Mars. My bad.
Yeah, it's 9.81 on Earth. But on other things, it's different. There is a big misconception between weight and mass, actually. Mass is physically how much of stuff you are. You know, if someone will weigh 70 kilograms, that's not actually 70 kilos of weight. That is 70 kilograms of mass. Weight is just what happens when you multiply that by this gravitational field strength. So your mass will be the same on here and on Mars, but your weight will be different. I mean, that's a whole thing. Nothing to do with pi, unless, of course, pi does somehow inflict your weight.
Well, edible pi might.
Edible pi might, yes. If you ended up eating transcendental pi, then you know, you might get quite heavy quite fast.
What would a mathematical pi be? Key prime pi.
Key prime pi. Is that the most mathematical pi you could think of?
Yeah, you can slice it in halves or thirds or fifths or
sevenths or reciprocal primes. Speaking of reciprocal primes, actually, this ties nicely with someone who's very, very famous in the calculations of pi by hand, which is William Shanks. He was around in the 1800s or so and was just a school teacher, was just a regular dude, but he was infatuated with the calculations of pi by hand. So he wanted to calculate it to as much as he can, and he used something called Machin's formula to get pi, and it did involve a lot of long division. More on that in just a moment. But he also calculated reciprocals of primes, which is quite fascinating. They're all listed in this text. But with his pi calculations, he calculated 707 digits, and everyone's like, wow, Shanks, you're great. That's crazy. And then a few hundred years later, someone was reading this text and realized that digit number 528 was wrong, which meant that every digit thereafter was also wrong. So Shanks really only calculated 527 digits of pi.
Well, this guy, Ferguson, who calculated it, used a desk calculator. And that was the last sort of inklings of calculating pi by hand. So has anyone tried doing something similar?
Yes, I'm sure our listeners are keen fans of Matt Parker, and canonically every 2 years he does a Pi Day video for some way in which to calculate pi to a strange number of digits. It does actually lead on nicely to the fact that I was there a few weeks ago.
Yeah, it does. So you calculated pi, or maybe you didn't calculate pi. Go on, Sam. Tell us the story.
I am here with Richard in London, attempting to calculate pi by hand. Those of you who are fans of Matt Parker will know that every couple of years he does some kind of weird and wacky challenge to calculate pi by hand to a stupid number of digits. And this year, we're trying to get to 100 by hand. It uses an arctan expansion. So again, for those who listen to our Sum of Surprises episode, will know exactly that there are some ways you can manipulate certain arctans to get to a value of pi. And we're trying to do that again here. The thing is that I stayed up for 24 hours doing the maths, and then Monday evening, 12:20, so 12 past midnight, I jumped on a coach down to London, and the coach trips to London, do not do them, please do not do them, means that I was there 7 a.m. Tuesday morning, ready to do some long division. Saying that though, I didn't do any long division throughout the entire week. I was head of the human photocopying team.
What is that?
Matteo can tell you more. Matteo, how would you sum up your experience of this week?
Well, you know, Sam, it's been a great time. It's just been a fantastic time.
I'm so glad you said that.
Such an amazing gathering of talented people. Getting to meet people who are also interested in this ridiculous computation, yeah, and learning the process. Dedicating themselves for a whole week to just long division, really. And I guess all the organization that goes with it. But just meeting a bunch of cool people, doing a crazy thing, getting ready to see what we've done today. I think everybody's nerves are high. But for me, it's
possibly
been...
both.
Yeah, precisely. For me, it's been just a really lovely time, to be honest.
And as heads of the human photocopying table, how would you describe what we have done, basically? Because it's not been long division.
Good question. That's quite a complex area. I would say what we do is we take computations that have been finished, chunks of long division, we copy over the information that's been done onto the next chunk that's going out so that people can do the next sections of long division and hopefully get the right digits.
One thing my family have asked me is why I've actually taken a week off uni to come down and do long division, and why is it actually so difficult? But it's quite a hard question to ask.
Yeah, it's really hard, actually. But basically the idea is we have some really big numbers that we have to divide and a lot of arctangents to compute, and that requires even more long division because the series expansion of an arctan is long division, long division, long division, long division. So in order to do that, we've opted to parallelize this, adding a layer of complexity, by splitting up the long divisions in a really complicated way.
And we thought that human photocopying would be a way lot simpler than it was. It started off with four people at a table, two of them copying papers, two of them checking. But I think today, on Sunday, the last day, I can't even count the number of teams or the number of people that we've got now.
Yeah, absolutely. It's gotten bigger than we could have ever imagined. Even Library Station, which is a station that hands out sheets of paper for reference, is a big station. So this is all
known as the Pibery.
Known as the Pibery, sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not on theme today. Yeah, it's just much more complex than we could have imagined. But everybody's doing an amazing job. And yeah, it's just...
Thank you very much.
Yeah, we like it very much.
And another really important part of the process is the archive team, which started out as just a box of scrap paper, but Inza is here to tell me a bit about the whole process.
Yeah, so initially the idea of the archive was a box where it'd come in and then it was sorted out.
Hang on, Matt's doing an announcement. This is going in the bloopers. Briefly then, what has Archive turned into?
So it started out as a box initially and just a pile of every arctan sorted out. But it was quickly noted that it should be made more than that. There was a day where I spend running around all day trying to trace something down because I had noticed on the checklist there were spines coming in, even though we'd never received the spine before it. I said it was something missing there. At the end of that day, I spend a good amount of hours, and the next day, a good amount of hours with Matteo, pretty much auditing everything, comparing every chunk to the one before it, every spine to the one before it. Same with the odds. And that is what Archive has now turned into, which is just 3 to 4 people doing that for every sheet that comes in, compare it to the chunk before, the spine before, and make sure everything's correct, which is like the last fail save before it gets stamped and put into the archive.
And how many errors have you checked? Well, how many errors have you cleared, I suppose, using that method?
In the archive, we have not cleared any methods, but we did a very big audit before the archive became the thing it is now. I think we've cleared about 10 errors from that. And initially in the archive, when it was just a box with me running around, there were about 20 faulty sheets out there that I've somehow managed to rescue from being put into collapse.
Well, we thank you for your service. Right, let's get on. Final day.
Yeah, let's go.
Okay, these are some interesting concepts and stuff that you did to get to that holy value of pi. Now, did you actually get somewhere?
Yeah, so at the time of release, I'm allowed to say it because the video will already be out. We had to because of time and the number of people, we calculated a maximum of 140 digits. And of those 140 digits, do you want to guess how many were correct? Bearing in mind that the last time they did this, they did 100 digits, or they calculated 100 digits and only 11 were correct.
Yeah, I'm going to say maybe 20.
20? Of the 140, 139 were correct.
That's superb. Hang on, what was the bad digit?
The bad digit was the very last digit.
Oh, thank God. I mean, if it was 3.2, then I think, yeah.
No, it was 3.14159, all the way up to the 139th digit, which is 7. Or, amazingly, this episode is episode number 17, and the final two digits of what we calculated were 17. So the Instagram post for this will be Richard next to 17. Here is a clip of what happened when we figured out we got it all correct.
We just did 582.
Yeah.
Then there's another 2.
Yes. Yeah.
Oh. 3.
Yeah.
Oh. Wow. 1.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh.
Come on. Let's go.
Okay, I mean, this is a lucky dip. 7?
Yes!
Oh my God!
6.
No.
Oh!
Well, that sounds like a lot of fun. I hear when one calculates pi to 139 places, you're never the same again. Is that true, Sam?
That is very, very true. And all of us involved are now on the shortlist for, I know, Pi Day 2026, when we'll probably try and get to pi 100 digits. I don't really know how you can get 0.1 of a digit.
I think it would probably be 314, maybe.
Yep, that's the one.
What method are you going to use now?
Probably another Matron series, but one that's more optimized now that we know the ins and the outs. Because we've got the whole thing down. Me as head of the human photocopiers, Inza and Matteo, they were good doing the archive and the audit. I mean, everyone has got their own process and they know how to do it. So we've just got to repeat it again in 2 years' time.
Good luck.
Thank you very much.
Or is it lightning struck in a bottle? You only get 139 digits.
No, we did so many checks though to get that it was, to make sure it was correct. But there we go. That's how it was.
Unlike pi and other irrational numbers, this episode and series must come to an end.
But fear not. As a little distraction from exam revision, I'm sure we can plan out a few episodes that are less heavy on the maths and more on, well, just talking nonsense.
I thought that's what we already did. Anyway, thanks for listening to this episode of Chalkboard Ultra, and actually for listening through to the end of our second series. We hope you found it as enlightening as we did.
Join us in the Easter term as we delve deeper in the wonders of mathematics. We promise to be more active on social media, so please do follow us on Instagram for promotions and on Twitter for the memes, at ChalkboardUltra, as always. Do let us know your favourite moments from this term.
Keep safe and keep well.
Podcasts.
Thanks for downloading this Purple Radio podcast. For more great content and to listen live, head to purpleradio.co.uk.